is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll explore what we mean by personalized cancer care. Also, how you can still live an active life with Parkinson's disease. But first, what is the infirmary at the State Fair? And how does it make your visit there much safer? Well, you know, the New York State Fair is upon us, and we have an estimated 1 million visitors each year. Someone has to look out for them. With us to fill us in on just how that's done are Dr. Jeremy Joslin, Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at Upstate Medical University and the Medical Director of the State Fair's Infirmary, and Jay Scott. He's the Director of Education Programs for the Department of Emergency Medicine and also the Director of Operations for the Fair's Infirmary. Welcome to you both.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks for coming in today. So Upstate has been manning the State Fair's Infirmary for a long time, right? And you do it for the whole 12-day run. How long has it been going on, Jay?
Dr. Jastrzemski actually started being the medical director from the fair since the early 80s, if I remember correctly.
So it's been quite a long time you've been doing this. So
it has.
Tell me what goes on there. Are you open 24/7, Dr. Joslin?
Well, there's certainly an emergency services presence there 24 hours a day. The actual infirmary has some set hours where we have normal operations up and running, 10 a.m. to about 10 p.m., maybe a little bit later depending on the day. That's when our normal operations are.
But what are the kinds of problems do you see? I mean, you know, obviously in the fair with 1 million people coming in a given year, I mean, there's in those 12 days span, you would think there are any number of things you could run into. What kinds of problems?
Yeah, there's a lot of problems. That's one of the benefits of working the fair is you sort of never know what you're going to see and what kind of goes with the fair. Certainly the most common things you would see are things you would expect when you have a lot of people outside in a summer day. So heat problems, exhaustion. You know, you have people who come from far and they stand on their feet in the sun sometimes several hours, and then towards the end of the day, problems with exhaustion start to set in. You get trips and falls and people who pass out. That's the usual thing, scrapes and bruises.
So I understand that you have a very, very state-of-the-art facility, though. Tell us about that, Jay.
The facility actually was designed and built in 2005 on a federal grant designed to be a surge capacity center with a lot of flexibility for...
What does that mean, a surge capacity center?
Surge capacity would be when a hospital or a medical facility exceeds its capacity, or there's for some reason we need to quarantine the emergency room. The thought and the design was that we could open the fair infirmary and use that as an extra place to see patients, to see people that were sick or injured.
So this is way beyond the time of the fair. You're saying year-round, if there were a problem with any of our hospitals being overcrowded or there was a massive disaster of some kind, people could use the fair infirmary.
That was the genesis for the fair infirmary, yes.
So correct. You're in a state-of-the-art facility right now?
It's about a 20,000-square-foot facility, complete with a small kitchen, an office space, a communications room, a triage area, a waiting room, and then currently 22 beds for patients that might get sick or injured.
Wow, and that's all available during the fair.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. So give us another example. I mean, do you ever see more serious problems? I mean, do you have an ambulance on site, for example, and when would you use that?
Yeah, certainly we see serious problems every year, just about every day during the fair with so many people there. It really is its own city. One of the interesting stats that I recently saw was the number of people who were at the fair. It really does compare to a significant sized city in the state of New York. So we see everything that you would expect to see in a city during a day, including some of the more serious things. There's certainly EMS presence. We don't particularly deal with that. That's done by Rural Metro here in Syracuse.
So if somebody were to have a heart attack mm-hmm. or threatening a stroke, you wouldn't necessarily take them to the infirmary. They would go the ambulance to a hospital?
Yeah, each person's a little bit different. We try to take each circumstance a little bit different and decide if getting them to the infirmary is better for them based on time, based on the problem. Perhaps it's something that we could stabilize at the infirmary first, which would benefit them from the few minutes of transport time to the hospital. Or if we realize that there really isn't much that we can do to stabilize them, they'd be better off at the hospital. We could directly transport them from wherever they had their problem in the fair. We sort of take that on a case-by-case basis. Certainly the paramedics are well-trained in dealing with that, and they look to us if they have questions about it as well.
So who staffs the infirmary? Are there physicians specifically?
Yes, we have physicians from our emergency department. Many of them are trained in pre-hospital medicine as well.
What do you mean when you say pre-hospital medicine?
Well, there's a new subspecialty in emergency medicine, EMS medicine, where emergency physicians mostly, although there are other specialties involved in it, can do extra training in the subspecialty of EMS medicine, which has sort of been around for several years, but now just recently becoming a true subspecialty recognized by the medical community.
So the point is they're learning, you're having physicians as opposed to an EMT, which is technician, a physician doing some of the things that perhaps would be too complicated for an emergency medicine technician to do?
Well, we have EMS, we have paramedics, we have EMTs that we interface with directly. There's certainly enough for them to do to keep busy, but yes, we also have physicians there to bring up the level of care to where it needs to be for such a large operation, and then we decide if the patient needs to leave or if we can treat them there.
Speaking about a large-scale operation, are you equipped, Jay, to handle like something, perhaps a large-scale disaster or a multiple injury circumstance, such like, for example, if a roller coaster, God forbid, went off its track and many people were injured, even up to 75 or 100 people would be injured. Would you be able to handle that at the infirmary?
We would certainly be able to start the process rolling. We'd be able to start the triage and the initial treatment of those people that needed to be stabilized right away. Again, the design of the infirmary is for large-scale events and for large-scale populations of people that are hurt. We have had instances in the past where more than one person has been hurt on a ride at any given event, and we kind of pride ourselves on our ability to triage quickly and take care of those people that need to be helped immediately.
It's amazing. It gives me a sense of calm just knowing that you guys are there. I guess fortunately, in all the years I've been going to the fair, I've never had need for your services, but I never realized to what degree you're equipped and capable of handling those kinds of things.
Yeah, God willing, nothing like that ever happens. There's certainly a lot of smart people who stay up at night thinking about these kinds of problems and putting together plans so that we could definitely be there and try to mitigate any of those problems.
What advice, either of you, jump in, would you give to people going to the fair? Jay?
Stay hydrated. Plan to be on your feet. Certainly bring your medications with you.
Take your normal medications.
And stay on your schedule. Stay on your diet. If you're on a salt-restricted diet, it might not make sense to eat a whole bowl full of chips while you're at the fair. So just use common sense.
And if you're not feeling well to begin with? If you've got a cold or
already not feeling well, or if you have a child that isn't feeling well that has a fever, maybe it's a good idea to stay home. Maybe come to the fair in a different time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about you?
Yeah, it's just a long day. So I think that just keeping that in mind and keeping the right perspective of it being a long day and taking care of yourself along the way really, really would help a person out a lot.
It seems to me that people should even be told to bring water with them, maybe an insect repellent, things like that. Are those important things?
Yeah, sure. And sunscreen as well. Don't forget the sunscreen.
Right.
For sunny days.
In the very few seconds we have left, any other advice for people this year? I mean, the fair is ongoing, and I think a lot of people are very excited. I think it's very exciting to know that you're both there and so many other people to support so many visitors.
I love the fair. I can't wait till it starts. It's going to be a good year.
The fair is there to have fun, so come out, relax, and enjoy yourself. Have a good time. If you need help, then call for help.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. My guests have been Dr. Jeremy Joslin, Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at Upstate Medical University and the Medical Director of the State Fair's Infirmary, and Jay Scott. He's the Director of Education Programming for the Department of Emergency Medicine, and he's the Director of Operations at the Fair's Infirmary. Coming up next, what seen by personalized cancer care. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Since the sequencing of the human genome in 2003, scientists have the ability to identify patients' susceptibility to many types of cancer and their response to specific treatments based on their own genetic makeup. Well, joining us this morning is Dr. Ajit Gajra. He's the Associate Professor of Medicine specializing in hematology and oncology, and he's also the Director of the Hematology-Oncology Fellowship Program at Upstate Medical University, and he's here to help us understand what exactly do we mean, Dr. Gajra, by personalized cancer care?
Great. So personalized cancer care is a term used to describe an ideal scenario or a utopia or a goal that we're headed towards where the therapy for each patient with cancer will be tailored to their specific individual cancer. So all patients with lung cancer that has, say, metastasized will now be offered the same treatment, the same kind of chemotherapy as we've been doing for several years. If we were to get there, or I should say when we get there, each patient's tumor characteristics will be used to determine what therapy is most suited to attack and kill their cancer. So that would be, in essence, what personalized cancer care.
So let me just get this straight so that I understand it, mm-hmm. and perhaps our listeners do. Currently, the state of affairs is more what we call targeted cancer therapy. Is there a difference there? Mm-hmm. So help us understand. Targeted means what?
Sure. So through the 90s and early part of 2000s, targeted therapy was the mantra, where what we as clinicians and scientists, the scientific and clinician community, oncologist community, thought that as long as we identify a marker on a particular tumor cell and we have an antidote, or we have, in other words, a medication or drug that attacks that target, then we should be able to effectively get rid of the cancer. And that's how the concept of targeted therapy was born.
So the concept there then was that, in a sense, all cancers, all lung cancers were the same. We just needed to identify the particular target that was common to lung cancer.
Correct.
And then direct different types of therapies to kill those cells.
Right.
But mm-hmm. let me just go back ask you. Mm-hmm. So with personalized, this is a little different or quite different. I understand you're saying we're not quite there yet mm-hmm. in all cases, mm-hmm. but the idea being that we're looking at the genetic makeup of a particular individual and their tumor, and so it's very much unique and tied to that person's genetic makeup. Is
correct.
That correct?
Correct. So, exactly. So, there are two parts to it, really. One is the genetic makeup of the individual. And as you correctly pointed out, with the Human Genome Project now complete and the cost of sequencing, you know, actually affordable, that is a step forward. However, another specific area is the expression or the genetic constitution of any individual cancer. So if we have 100, you know, women with, say, metastatic breast cancer, who've been diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, then they can have, even though it's metastatic breast cancer, and under the microscope it may look, if not identical, quite similar, their actual genetic components will be distinct. And so each of these tumors might have varied expressions and varied drivers of what is driving the cancer. So there are really two components to it, the individual or the host and the host's genetic makeup, and it interplays with the tumor. And then the tumor itself with its various drivers, let's say, or factors or cytokines, the things that drive the tumor to grow and proliferate. operate. And what we really hope to do is come up with a distinct treatment. So, you know, the mantra used to be a single pill for every patient. So a medication so specific that will be specific for every individual. Or, you know, the term individualized medicine has also been used. However, you know, I think we're taking small steps in that direction. We're not completely there yet.
Well, how would, I guess the question here would be, how would, you know, again, theoretically, how would you go about developing a particular drug for an individual? And is that even cost effective?
Excellent, excellent question. So, so that's where the new big a thrust is in cancer care. So let me give you an example. I treat a lot of patients with lung cancer, so we're going to use lung cancer as an example. So up until 15 years ago, we just used to divide lung cancer into two broad categories, non-small cell and small cell. And then treatments, which were mainly chemotherapy treatments, were directed against one type or the other type. Then we've known that, so I'll give you an example. So there was this medication called pemetrexed, which was, when it was first approved, it was for all non-small cells. But then along the way, we realized that it actually doesn't seem to work that well for a type of non-small cell, which is squamous cell. So when further research was done, it was actually known that squamous cells don't respond to pemetrexed. And so now we don't use it for squamous cell, but we use it for adenocarcinomas.
So you further differentiated what you could use a particular drug for.
For, correct. Now, going further, what we've done is, or what research has brought us, is that there are, within adenocarcinomas, there are various mutations. So a lot of sequencing work was done on adenocarcinomas of the lung to identify what patients have what types of mutations, and broad patterns have emerged. So for instance, there are patients, you know, again, a minority of patients, unfortunately, but a group of patients, say up to even 11 to 13% of patients with adenocarcinoma of the lung who have this mutation called EGFR mutation or epidermal growth factor receptor mutation. Why we like to find this is because we have a medication that works very well against EGFR mutation positive patients. So a lot of work was put into this. And again, this medicine called erlotinib and another medicine prior to that, when they were first used, they were used on all comers. And they didn't work always because not all patients had that mutation. But now knowing that patients who have the mutation, when we use erlotinib, we have a much higher rate of success.
So bottom line on all of this is that what they're trying to do is match a patient's tumor with a drug that specifically targets it. And they might test the tumor samples for genetic mutations that are responsible for its tumor growth, and then they match the drugs.
Precisely. And what is going on now is, now that we've discovered this, in the past, what was happening was that the development was lopsided. You come up with a new drug, and then you just test it in all sorts of folks. Now, the development is going to be more prospective. In other words, identify mutations and their attacking agents or drugs that work against those mutations.
So tailor-made.
Tailor-made ahead of time so that we're not wasting precious time. And so in the future, you know, once a patient's diagnosed, we have all that information already, what sort of mutations they harbor, and we already have a series of agents that we know work against those mutations. So
help us understand real briefly, because I don't want to run out of time. There's much I'd like to ask you about this. We have some examples of success. Can you give us a couple?
Right. So like I said, you know, erlotinib story is a little bit older. What's more recent is this, again, you know, going, building up on that story of just, say, lung cancer adenocarcinomas. It was noticed that there are some patients who seemed like they might have EGFR type mutations, but they didn't, and they did not respond to erlotinib. So when further work was done, it was discovered that they have a different type of mutation called the ALK mutation. And there was an agent which is now available for treatment of these patients with the ALK mutation.
Wow.
And, you know, again, in the North American population, unfortunately, it's, you know, only about 4 to 7% of folks. But again, so I think the point that I want the folk, you know, our listeners to know is that it isn't going to be one shoe fits all. And we have to keep slicing, any particular type of cancer to identify more and more subsets. And again, even since that time, we've discovered more mutations, and drugs are in development for those specific mutations. Some of these are only seen in 1 and 2%, but that's the whole point. We don't want to lose even 1 or 2% because cancer is a very heterogeneous disease, so it's not the same disease in all individuals.
So what are the barriers to success?
Right. So, you know, it all seems easy to talk about, but there are, of course, I think I would put it as,
Is funding a big barrier?
Absolutely. So, you know, money. So cost is always an issue. A lot of research has to go into this area, you know, to come up with one viable option. Oftentimes it's said that, you know, you have to test 50 before you come up with one option that's actually useful. So, and then that kind of research needs a lot of funding. We all know that the funding atmosphere is not the best in the country right now.
Right, especially in our current state of affairs in Washington.
Correct. Right. So with the recession and everything, you know, funding has taken a big hit, and unfortunately looks like it's going to decline further. Another barrier is that there is a lot of information that exists in science. So there is a lot of work that's been done already in the lab, but then bringing it to the clinic and applying it, you know, bringing it actually to the patient.
Bench to bedside kind of
idea. Absolutely. So, you know, so that interface is often lacking. So what's really important is the wedding or the partnership of scientists with the clinicians. So really a multidisciplinary approach where a scientist who's involved in drug development, or these days, you know, many large cancer centers are even starting to have, you know, departments of personalized care, where this work of identifying new mutations can go on simultaneously. And then the third is really patient confidentiality, because, you know, you're working with the genetic makeup of a patient, so you really have a lot of responsibility to protect
that's
their
really their
privacy.
Identity. That's their true. Genetic that, identity.
That's their genetic
talk
fingerprint.
Talk about identity theft. Right. So how do we get there faster? I don't want to run out of
time.
Sure.
So I think, investing in partnerships, some of them have to be pharmaceutical partnerships with academic institutions. Really, it's got to be a team effort. So our patients have to participate in research. They have to sign up for clinical trials, because we will not make progress.
Speaking of clinical trials, so what's happening right here in Central New York at Upstate?
Right.
I mean, without going through the entire range of what's happening, just in general, how are we participating?
Yes, so I think we're very fortunate here in that we have, you know, several multidisciplinary teams in almost all major cancer types who are very active in our national alliance group, which is a group which sponsors clinical trials, which are sponsored by the National Cancer Institute, and a variety of trials in every disease, be it lung cancer, be it bladder cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, a variety of trials.
Are taking place currently?
Currently
at Upstate.
Absolutely.
And you're part of a larger, through the NCI, the National Cancer Institute.
A larger consortium.
Of studies. So we're playing a part in all of this movement going forward.
Not only that, many of our researchers are actually instrumental in writing or developing those clinical trials. So
right.
That's, I think, critical.
You know, this is such hopeful and positive information. Cancer is so devastating, and it is kind of endemic. And all these different types of cancers, many of which are so lethal and silent. So the fact that there may be some hope down the road, and especially this kind of personalized care so that people can have a more targeted approach and maybe not suffer all the side effects, is very, very hopeful. I want to thank you so very much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Ajit Gajra. He's the Associate Professor of Medicine specializing in hematology and oncology, and he's the director of the Hematology Oncology Fellowship Program at Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. stuck forever or curiouser and curiouser? Well, folks, you know how we get to stuck spots on the way from here to there in our lives? Maybe with our job or our main squeeze. Boy, long time since that expression popped out. Or with changing a bad habit or starting a good one, like moving the bod a bit more, getting more sleep, acting less cranky and more kindly, thank you very much, or eating more fruits and veggies, or spending less time making lists of stuck spots and more time actually doing something new. And stuck can feel pretty crummy. Recently, I've been percolating on a few of my specific stucknesses and how to move from stuck to unstuck. What's helping me? Well, my discoveries so far. First, not taking my stuckness too seriously helps. After all, stuck is just the pause between here and there. And it feels less ugh, yuck, arg, or aye if I remind myself of that between the uggs, yucks, args, and ayes. And stuck is not because I'm the biggest loser in the world, but just because I'm a human being. And stuck is in the Homo sapien job description. And as the cognitive therapists with their millions of research studies suggest, it helps to quit the stinking thinking like, I'm stuck, and instead think, I'm developing. Right? But most surprising, just relaxing my muscles, feeling my breathing body, and redirecting my neurons from stuck to gazing at the seemingly impenetrable, insurmountable, and impossible with my curiosity frees me to moving my head and bod ahead anew. Curiosity. I'm Dr. Rich, Brain Shifter O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next up, how can you live an active life with a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease? And don't forget to stick around for a visit from the Healing Muse. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for August 19th. Set aside the soda. Soft drinks are the single largest contributor to the total calorie intake of Americans, and numerous studies have linked increased intake of sweetened beverages to rising American obesity rates over the past few decades. While this info may motivate you to reach for a diet soda, there are disagreements over the benefits of artificially sweetened beverages that may actually increase appetite and encourage weight gain. Try to kick your soda habit this week. Choose water with a squeeze of citrus, unsweetened tea, or 100% fruit vegetable juice instead of a soft drink to save calories and reduce your hunger. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. As many as 1 million Americans live with Parkinson's disease, which is more than the combined number of people diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy, and Lou Gehrig's disease. But the good news is that living with this debilitating disease today is not always as debilitating as once thought. And here with more on all of this is Dr. Dragos Mihaila. He is the assistant professor of neurology and the director of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Clinic at the Syracuse Veterans Administration Medical Center and at Upstate Medical University. And Carol Sames, she's an exercise physiologist and the director of the Vitality Fitness Program at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Mihaila, let's begin with helping us understand, what exactly do we mean when we talk about Parkinson's disease? What is it?
Well, Parkinson's disease carries the name of James Parkinson, who described this condition in 1817 when he personally examined three patients, and he observed three other patients on the streets of London carrying the same manifestations of physical disabilities, with tremor, with slowness of movements, and difficulties with walking. Since then, we have made some progress in describing more about this condition, which carries now Dr. James Parkinson's name.
So it's a nervous, it's a progressive disorder?
It is correct? A progressive disorder of the nervous system, which affects predominantly the dopamine-producing neurons. Dopamine is a chemical that is used by the brain to smooth out the movements, to initiate movements, and so plays a significant role in the physical abilities of everybody.
Does it come on immediately? Is it something you're struck with?
The disease does not start suddenly. It is a progressive, a slowly progressive disease that may start quite slowly, usually on one side of the body, and just gradually progresses to affect the arm, the leg on the same side, then move to affect the other side as well. And in time, I'm talking about years, it affects the balance and also ability to straighten up, and affects the posture of these patients.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the symptoms. So it might start with something as simple as a tremor in one hand.
It might start with a simple tremor of a pinky finger or the thumb.
Wow.
And then progresses to affect the whole hand, and then maybe the leg may start in the leg, not necessarily in the hand.
So the kinds of things we see are tremor, a slowness of movement,
stiffness of the body,
rigidity.
It may start actually, the first signs you may observe is that that person does not swing their arm when they walk, which we normally do, and that may be lost.
Interesting.
I want to mention also that tremor is the most recognized sign of Parkinson's disease. However, 1 in 5 people who have Parkinson's disease never develop tremor.
Oh, that's really interesting. So what would they be developing that would show itself?
Slowness of movements. That is mandatory to have a diagnosis of Parkinsonism.
And are there
all slowness of movement?
What other kinds of symptoms? In other words, are there changes in their speech, for example, or in other abilities?
Absolutely. The speech becomes softer. The words are not really well formed.
Not articulated well.
Absolutely. And people start developing difficulties with dexterity. They may notice difficulties buttoning their buttons, brushing their teeth, even shampooing their hair. They cannot do this, you know, really movements with their hand.
Now, Carol, you also, I mean, you work as part of the Vitality Program. You have people with Parkinson's disease as part of your patients that you see. What kinds of symptoms are most prevalent that you notice in Parkinson's?
So just as Dr. Mihaila had suggested, we will see individuals who have tremor. The shuffling gait is pretty hallmark, not again in everyone, but a decreased stride, inability to flex the foot. And so the person, as they start to lose some of their postural reflexes, you start to see them stooping forward, which then, of course, puts them at high risk for falls.
So when you say shuffling gait, you mean they kind of just move one foot in front of the other,
right,
very slowly?
You know, the typical gait pattern is a heel landing and rolling to toe, as Dr. Mihaila had mentioned, opposite arm to leg that's forward. And so you start to see arms that are not moving in conjunction, a smaller stride, and more of that shuffling.
How about people being frozen? That's something that I've heard about.
It is. It is one of the physical manifestations of Parkinson's disease that starts later than the tremor, later than the slowness of movements. And this freezing, which affects mostly the legs, it's called freezing of gait, is quite debilitating. All of a sudden, these patients cannot initiate their walking. The freezing of gait is more likely to be observed when the first steps are initiated, when people are turning, or, interesting, when they pass through a threshold like a doorway, or when they are in the front of an escalator. Don't be surprised to see a Parkinson's patient being stuck in place, unable to move.
Wow.
What is very interesting and where the Vitality Program may play a really a role is the fact that with cues, different cues like visual cues, auditory cues, these people can unblock their freezing and
really?
They can move.
So they can compensate with the right kind of training, which I really want to get to because that's what this is all about. I think
Absolutely.
The key here is that people with Parkinson's can really do something to help themselves. But I want to talk more specifically about what treatments other than intervention in terms of the exercise and the lifestyle changes. What actual medical treatments are available these days?
Well, as I mentioned, Parkinson's disease is a progressive degeneration of the brain. Unfortunately, at this point, we do not have a proven intervention that would slow down the disease progression. So the treatment addresses the symptoms, the physical problems that these patients have. And the treatment, the medical treatment, is concentrating on restoring or replacing the lack of dopamine that they have.
So there's a medicine
There are several medications that address this, and the most powerful drug we have for it is the drug called levodopa, which is the precursor of dopamine. The levodopa is almost like a folded in, a form of dopamine that is folded because it can pass through the barrier between the blood and the brain. So it can reach the brain. And in the brain, it unfolds and
wow.
as a dopamine.
Is that effective in
most
cases?
It is the most effective form of medication we have for Parkinson's disease.
Is that taken orally on a daily basis?
It is taken orally on a daily basis, initially taken 3 times a day, but as the disease progresses and the longer the patients are exposed to the medication, they develop some of the unwanted side effects of these medications, which are the so-called motor fluctuations. When this medication is a short-acting drug, initially in the beginning of the therapy, people they have their own dopamine so they can compensate. But as the disease progresses, they rely more and more on the properties of the drug. And this is a short-acting drug. So they may observe the improvement of the symptoms for an hour, 2 hours, and then gradually or sometimes suddenly they return to the state of Parkinsonism with the stiffness, with a tremor, and with the slowness of movements and difficulties walking. Also, another potential side effect of the medication, about half of the patients develop this, are the so-called dyskinesias. These are involuntary movements. Many times these movements are mild, not even observed by the patient, observed by others, but sometimes they can be severe enough to play around in disrupting the ability to walk, balance, and ability to use upper arms and hands in different activities.
So when you talk about dyskinesia in this case, it's a side effect of the drug. It's not part of Parkinson's.
Absolutely.
And some, like Michael J. Fox, for example, is to me a perfect poster child in the sense that he's been doing incredible things to raise the awareness and consciousness of the importance of helping, raising money for Parkinson's research. But he seems to have a lot of this writhing kind of movement. Is that the kind
it's
of thing
exactly
you're talking
the, it's
about?
It's exactly what I'm talking about. But despite his movement, with this movement present, he's able to do everything else. When he does not have these movements, he's stiff, frozen, unable to talk, probably.
So apart from the medical intervention, which obviously is very effective, I read somewhere there is some surgical interventions been around for a bit. Tell us about the deep brain stimulation.
Deep brain stimulation has been around for a number of years, and it is a powerful way of treating the motor fluctuations and dyskinesias in Parkinson's disease. It has almost the same effect as levodopa, but provides this continuous stimulation of the...
So instead of... It's almost like a time-released capsule, so to speak.
Exactly. We call it actually electronic levodopa.
Oh.
This is how it is very effective and actually can allow these patients to reduce their amount of medication they are taking. And
so how is that accomplished? What exactly, and very briefly, what exactly is done?
We are jamming bad signals in the networks in the brain.
Wow.
So this is
electronically jamming bad signals.
So we place this DBS lead, a neurosurgeon places this deep brain stimulation lead in the brain, connects it with a pacemaker, and that pacemaker sends this high frequency, very low voltage electric current to the brain, to that specific target in the brain, the subthalamic nucleus or the globus pallidus pars interna, and that kind of jams these kind of bad signals that are probably caused by
the lack of dopamine. Wow, so
yes.
It's literally, it's like you said, it's like electronically jamming the bad signals so people can resume what their normal functioning might be.
Absolutely.
What about new research? Things like stem cell research or genetic therapy, is any of that on the...
Of course, this is what we are dreaming of, having a treatment that can restore the lost brain cells and stem cells. Has a lot of promise, but it's still a technology that is in infancy when it comes to treatment of these neurodegenerative conditions.
Right.
I have to mention that Parkinson's disease is not only a physical disorder, a physical function disorder. It affects tremendously other functions
central
nervous system.
Such as
cognitive function.
Cognitive
mood.
So is dementia also a factor?
Yes, it is.
But it's not the case in all people who have Parkinson's.
No, but the longer you live with Parkinson's disease, the higher is the chance of getting dementia, autonomic dysfunction, people having difficulties maintaining the blood pressure when they are standing. They may pass out. Troubles with controlling of the bladder function.
So there's
sleep problems.
So it has a very wide-ranging impact on life. Carol, that's where you come in. Tell us a little bit about what you find and what you do with patients with Parkinson's as part of the Vitality program.
Well, certainly it's important that all of us be active. And just because somebody comes in with a diagnosis of Parkinson's, that does not change. So what we want to do is we want to look at all these symptoms that we've been talking about. We also want to look at, cognitive function, and we want to look at are they cycling off some of these medications where they have on time and off time? Because certainly we don't want to have them exercising in an off time. It's not going to be effective for them. We're going to look at their balance. And so that we're going to set up a program that's going to include some range of motion.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. I'm here with neurologist Dr. Gragos Mihaila and exercise physiologist Carol Sames. We're talking about how to live an active life with Parkinson's disease. So tell me a bit more about what exactly it is that you guys do.
So we want to do some range of motion, flexibility. We want to work on balance. We want to work on strength. We need muscle to move.
So how is it that happens? In other words, do people come on a once-a-week basis? Do they come multiple times a week if they're engaged in your program?
2 to 3 times a week. Generally speaking, one time a week, unless they were able to do things on their own, isn't really going to be effective. We have both a water program and a traditional land exercise program. And for some individuals that have more advanced Parkinson's, where we're really concerned about falls, the water is an ideal environment with the buoyancy and the resistance.
Is diet a part of this also? When we talk about a healthy lifestyle, are you also encouraging a healthier diet overall?
Certainly we want everybody to have a healthy diet. For many people, if they've been inactive, we want them to start with activity first, talk about what's going to be safe for them, and then gradually work on more education, and that would certainly include nutrition.
Dr. Mihaly was alluding to the fact that some people, if they're given proper cues, which is what I would think would come with the kind of training you're offering, they can overcome or compensate for some of the limitations of Parkinson's. What have you seen?
The frozen, absolutely. So it could be as simple as telling somebody, instead of taking a step forward because they're frozen, take a step backwards. That could be that simple.
In the little bit of time we have left, I just want to make sure. It seems to me that this whole disease entity could play a real wreak havoc in a family life and caregiver's life, and how support would probably be a very, very important thing. Is that what you're seeing, too?
Yes, absolutely. There is a significant stress on the caregivers of people who have Parkinson's disease. And this is something that we sometimes fail to address properly when we see the patients in the clinic. But family is so important. And mentioning the physical exercise, it's important that a caregiver will do the physical exercises with the patient because the dual benefit. Briefly, I want to mention that there is physical exercise has possible and neuroprotective properties. And we get more and more data, is emerging data in that field.
Wonderful. Well, we also have some information about some support groups, and we're going to have that information on our website. The Onondaga County Department of Aging and Youth is sponsoring two groups, and we'll have that information on our website, HealthLinkOnAir, that's one word, .org. And you're going to be participating in a mini conference on living in an active life with Parkinson's disease on September 12th coming up. So we will have that information as well on our website. I want to thank you both for coming in. My guests have been Dr. Dragos Mihaly, and he's the neurologist, associate assistant professor of neurology, and the director of the Parkinson's Movement Clinic at Upstate Medical University, and also Carol Sames, and she is an exercise physiologist and the director of the Vitality Fitness Program at Upstate Medical University.
Hello, this is Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate's Literary Journal, with this week's offering from the Healing Muse. There's nothing sadder than dealing with the approaching death of a loved one. This poem is extremely dramatic. It's called Nothing Better Than This. It's by a young writer who is a school social worker. Her name is Jennifer Heatley. She's from Ithaca, New York. I find this piece extremely powerful. Nothing Better Than This, in memory of Karen Detweiler. That night, we sat eating chocolate cake on your back deck under a vast and velvety sky speckled with stars, the sublime backdrop for two conversations, the one spoken and the one not. Mostly, we held on to the silence like a raft in a river of possible words. There were the things we chose not to speak about, like the purple scar tissue that remained where your breasts used to be, or the old attempts at jokes about the oddities of cancer, like living life in the bald, no more bad hair days, and being liberated from the tyranny of bras. We did not chuckle anymore about how I used to think that an oncologist was a doctor who specialized in being on call, because I knew now too well. Nor did we speak of the prognosis that was not getting any better, or your estimated departure that was growing nearer. I knew you knew, and you knew that I knew it would be coming soon enough, so why speak of it? To have spoken of anything related to death would have been unholy in the company of so many stars. For now, it was not here. This was today, and you were alive and grateful and not in too much pain. It was not tomorrow when they would find another metastasis, or the next day, or the day after, when hope would get whittled away, the woody curls of its ghost at our feet. No, not now. Now I savored each morsel of every moment with you still in the world, baked every bit into memory so I could taste it again and again. Now you sat with your legs contentedly crossed, an empty plate and fork resting in your lap, chocolate still melting on the back of your tongue. Now you were luminous as any star, stripped as you were by that six-letter disease down to your shining essence. And now you needed this moment to be free of death, to let your blood and marrow sing along with the cicadas and peepers in their evening hymn of praise by the pond. Your vision had changed. Polarized by your fate, colors were more vibrant, and your eyes only had room for beauty. You nodded at the sky and said to the stars, yourself and me, it doesn't get any better than this. Yes, I said, knowing. That was as true as Polaris was north, and for our own different reasons, neither of us wanted to give the power of sound to the other word, the other shining truth inside of longing, which was as real as this beauty, the simple plea that we wanted more.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Be sure to stop by and see Upstate at the New York State Fair, Thursday, August 22nd through Labor Day, September 2nd, inside the Science and Industry Building, to the right of the main gate. HealthLink On Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio, produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.